Commerce Committee has called for order. Members present, Representative Boucher, Ms. Furnace, Representative Davidson, Representative Ellis, and Vice Chair Copeland now chairing the first bill before the House Bill 403, an act relating to insurance coverage for treatment of alcoholism and drug abuse. And the prime sponsor is here to present the statement. And after the statement, if you would join us at the table for the secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm going to be very brief in my comments. There are a lot of people here who want to testify on the bill, and I think through their testimony, a lot of the questions of the committee can be answered. I'm going to just say that the bill is straightforward in what it would do, and that is that it would mandate inclusion of alcoholism and drug abuse treatment in medical insurance policies in Alaska. We do have an amendment that is in all of your packets and includes a change to only major medical insurance policies, since that was my intent and the intent of the sponsor on the Senate side. So that my statement is that it would only mandate inclusion in major medical insurance policies in the state of Alaska with the adoption of that amendment. There are 34 other states that have either mandated coverage, such as is being proposed in this legislation, or a mandated offering. It's not something that hasn't been done elsewhere. The arguments you're going to hear today, pro and con, are arguments that have been hashed out through other states. Just a moment to talk about perhaps the goals or my goals and my interest in introducing the legislation. And kind of the base goal here is that you want to provide, or I'd like to provide, a broader opportunity for victims of alcoholism and drug abuse to get treatment. That's a kind of a large thing to do, and this is only one way of doing it. There are clearly lots of other ways, but that's the basic underlying goal here. Another goal is that this is a way, and certainly a tool, that can be used to reduce the long-term cost of care. It's a cost containment tool, if you will, and there'll be people that will talk about that, just what this kind of mandated coverage does to the long-term cost of care as it relates to other non-alcohol and non-drug abuse kinds of care. Also, the reduction of long-term financial costs to small businesses through a preventive approach to public health is something that's also a possibility through the enactment of this type of coverage. It's tough to talk about the long-term reductions when a small business is facing its payroll next week, but it's clearly a long-term goal, something that the studies do bear out as a result of enactment of this type of legislation. It's certainly, again, a major goal of mine is to reduce costs to small businesses over the long term. And lastly, it also brings consistent coverage to all those who are insured. There are a number of insurers in the state who do provide some level of coverage for alcoholism and drug abuse currently, but it's inconsistent in its application. And what this bill would do is offer a consistent type of coverage for all plans, all major medical plans in the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I could open up for questions or try to answer questions that committee members may have, but that's the bill in a nutshell. You do have in your packets supporter statements from different state agencies, as well as, well, I guess, the Democratic Party also passed a resolution on Saturday supporting a bill of this nature. You see also in your packets fiscal notes from state departments, from Division of Insurance, Department of Administration, Health and Social Services, indicating zero fiscal impact to the state. That chiefly from, and each agency can speak for themselves, but because the state's policy already covers this type of coverage in one case, and others it's administrative, there's no burden. But anyway, I'd certainly answer questions if people have them. If I can't, I'll defer to people who are a lot better informed than I on this subject.
Thank you, Representative Boyer. Any questions, Representative Boucher?
Does the state provide this for its employees?
It's currently covered under the state's policy, yes. And again, the Department of Administration is here and they can answer that in more detail. But yes.
In other words, all state employees, to the care, all state employees are covered in a similar manner?
In a similar manner, yes. The numbers, I think, are different as far as the level of coverage, but yes, the coverage is provided.
How much does it cost the state to do that?
I'll defer to
Mr. Chairman, Bob Stallnaker, Acting Director for the Division of Retirement Benefits. We don't have the cost broken out specifically for this type of coverage. The state has provided this since the inception of providing health insurance. It does cover it in different levels. As a matter of fact, it covers it to a greater extent than what this bill is providing for. There are some technical aspects of this bill that we would like to see some technical amendments made. We've already discussed with the sponsor on the Senate side of these kind of technical amendments. But as far as we're concerned, the current coverage is provided by the state. I really can't tell you a specific cost for this element of the whole health insurance package.
Just to follow up on that, obviously the vendor that's insurer you brings that cost factor into the overall premium, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boucher, yes, that's an element of cost.
So could we not find out from the vendors how much of the total premium that cost?
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly find out what element of the premium is for the alcohol coverage. Sure.
My purpose in this line of question is to find out how much it's going to cost in the business community. And is, by adding this cost, is that going to solve the problem?
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the things we've also asked, or Senator Binkley's asked Department of Administration to do is give us some indication of how many state employees actually avail themselves of this benefit. And they've had it, as you've just heard, for many years. And the reason why that is important is to help in determining the cost of this benefit. And in looking at it, there have been lots of studies that have been done. Again, there are 34 other states, so it's not a new subject. There is a lot of data available, and people are looking at the cost issue. So it's important to understand the use versus the cost, whether or not the cost is incidental to the existing policy, whether or not it's based on some people would have you believe that there's going to be a rush to the door, cattle to the gate, to take advantage of this. And we don't know the answer in Alaska, based even on our public employees. It's not a number that they were able to give us right away. But clearly, those are things that I'm concerned about, and we should all be concerned about.
Well, Mark, let me give you the big picture thought on it. Mm-hmm. There are some companies themselves, in fact, it's becoming more of a national trend. The company recognizes that their bottom line is affected by the performance of their employees, and they are dealing with this internally. Let's say, for example, you have 1,000 people that you're insured, but maybe they're only dealing with 5 or 10 people that have alcoholism or drug-related problems on it. But this would require that all 1,000 be insured. Am I not correct?
That's correct.
That's what I want to see. I want to see the economics of the thing. It's not rather socially we should be dealing with alcoholism or drug abuse. I think all of us agree that we should. But is this the right way?
Sure.
To do it is a question I have in my mind.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, that's an actuary exercise too. It's something that, I mean, the insurance companies have the numbers on this, and it's something that they can say for every 100 or every 1,000 in population or covered employee that there's an X percentage is going to generally avail themselves of this, and that's all cranked into the offering too.
Then one final thing, and I'd like to know what is being done in the private sector. And I'm sure there is a lot being done to come to grips with the problem, which basically is to help a person who's an alcoholic or help a person who is using drugs. There may be some innovative solutions that are going on out there right now that we may not be aware of.
Those I'll let, Mr. Chairman, people in the audience who are involved in that industry talk about.
Okay.
Well, one of the things, too, that I was going to bring this to folks' attention is that there are, one of the issues that has been raised in the last week has to do with whether or not self-employers or employers who are, the term of art is multi-employer trusts, have multi-employer trusts in the state, provide this kind of coverage. And clearly the bill excludes people who are self-insuring or multi-employer trusts from coverage. What Senator Binkley had done is ask just for a very cursory look at some of the larger companies in the state who are either self-insured or METs to see whether or not they provided this coverage. And I think you may not have this in your package yet, and we'll certainly make it available, but there are six companies, and the largest ones, Fred Meyer, Pay and Save, Nordstrom's, ARCO, Chevron, and Standard Alaska, all of them in their own policies, whether or not those are METs or self-insured or through their union relationships, provide for this level of, or this type of coverage in their policies.
Can we have that put in the
copy? Make sure that this is available. One other thing before I leave is I think the committee has been has got copies of proposed amendments. They're technical in nature, and they're amendments that we support. One is from the Division of Insurance, and they can speak to their amendments, and also the Division of Retirement Benefits from DOA had similar amendments with.
For the record, the amendment label 51683AA4 will be referred to as amendment number one when we start working on it, and the one that is 51383AB should be amendment number two. I guess those are the two that we
yes,
have.
Mr. Chairman. Actually, for the record, too, the double A is of the Division of Insurance, and the AB is from the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And if I can, there were a couple of changes, I think, from your copy on the double A, the second amendment, which on page one reads page two, line 22. That should be scratched from your amendment. That actually referred to what is now a blank space just above it. It was I had another amendment that is not now part of that. So this is no longer
we'll deal
germane.
With that when we go through the amendment.
Okay, good. We
Representative Furness had a question.
Well, I just wanted to follow up. Representative Boucher mentioned inquired about the cost of the private sector. I believe this information here supports that some private sector companies are providing a level of insurance equal or perhaps better than what the bill is addressing. I know too that there's no fiscal note, which tells me that the bill is, I'm going to make sure this is correct understanding, that the bill is targeted primarily at the companies that are providing certain coverages to make sure that they do not discriminate against the offering of the services if the policy included.
What the bill does is require that anybody providing any, medical
insurance
coverage, right,
yeah,
in they provide that kind of coverage in that policy. So that's why there's no fiscal note, no
right,
fiscal impact on state government at this point. So one of the reasons why.
So I guess the answer towards the private sector, if the private sector has a policy, the company, the insurer, the ones that's providing that coverage, is to include at least the minimum level of the coverage in this bill. I assume that the option that the private sector company has is if it can't afford it, simply doesn't buy it. But is that what
well, you? I suppose there. Yeah, one of the options would be that you would you could eliminate the number of people that were covered under your policy, i.e. you could pull back from covering a family, say, to just the employee, him or herself. I mean, there are a number of things. You could do drop the policy altogether and quit providing coverage for your employees. There's a lot of information on that subject, just what it is, what the effects of this kind of legislation have on companies and employees. And one piece that's in your packet is something called the effect of mandated drug, alcohol, and mental health benefits on group health insurance premiums. It's from the Journal of the American Society of Civil Liberties Union, where they have looked at six states, I think from 1985 to early 1987, and gone through some of the same questions that are being raised here. And the upshot is that, if I may just read in part, that we have found no dramatic premium increase in the state study due to mandated mental health, alcohol, and drug benefits. The number of claims for these benefits as a percentage of the total claim exposure was not significant in their experience. The major carrier reported premium increases in two states after mandated benefits were enacted. We believe it fair to assume that in many cases the premium increases indicated were the result of prospective rate increases by the insurers as opposed to rate adjustments based on actuarial experience. You can read the balance of that yourself, but there is information on all sides of the issue, as you might appreciate or can appreciate.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Boyer, let me draw your attention to page 3, section 3, other provisions applicable. Could you explain what that section says and what it means?
I'll leave that to legal division, okay. But we do have a list of the various statutes and what those statutes are. I've got that, and I think that's been made available to the committee as well.
I've read this section, Mr. Chairman, and it does sort of pop out. It doesn't say anything, which concerns me. Oftentimes, it may escape us, so we need to have a clear understanding as to the benefit of this section to the overall bill and specifically its interpretation.
Let me talk about what's happening in the big picture. We're attempting to come to grips with workman's comp. It appears that's going to be a very rough and rocky road. We add this in, which people, once again, it's the cost of doing business. Might it not be appropriate, or it would have been appropriate to have incorporated it in that area there as we deal with these overall costs of doing business?
Mr. Chairman, as a cost of doing business, it's certainly something we should look at. I think we're doing that through this process, but it's certainly not germane to the issue of workers' compensation per se and shouldn't have been included in that discussion. But as part of I don't believe anyway, that's a very specific and narrow area of insurance, and this is another very specific and narrow area of insurance, and I think you need to keep them separate, but I think you're right that you need to look at the whole impact on small businesses.
Why is there no provisions in the workers' comp for treating people that have got alcoholism problems or drug problems?
Only if they're work-related, I guess.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about. Is there some, Mr. Chairman, you've dealt with it. Explain a little bit. Suppose a person was getting drunk on the job, and then he says, well, I get drunk on the job.
It's hard to
imagine. It's work-related?
Unless it's exposure to something that intoxicates them, I don't think it would really fit. However, alcoholism would make a person more prone to injury on the job, so controlling alcoholism certainly control the injury rate and therefore lower the cost of workers' comp, which is sensitive to the payout rate due to injury. So this could have an effect, but it's not a direct effect.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like also before I give the seat here to make one other comment that in a document that had been put together by Blue Cross and Blue Shields dealing with state-mandated health care coverage laws, it's just literally a compendium of states and what they do provide or don't provide as far as mandated coverages. Alaska, while we have a small amount of mandated coverages, does have, as of 887, nine mandated coverages in our law, three of which were added last year. Physical therapists, occupational therapists, and naturopaths under similar kind of legislation. And the states are all over the board as to the kinds of things. California, I think, being the state.
That's included in what piece of
it's something I just literally picked up before I came down here, so it's not part of the record.
Can we get a copy of that?
We can make that a copy.
Yeah, I'd like that part of the record. Then.
Okay. Again, the argument has been around for a long, long time. In its purest sense, it gets down to whether or not you agree with mandating coverage or not. And if once you've made that decision, you can argue it from many, many sides. But that's really the crux of the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If there are no further benefits, I'd like to depart from the usual order. And since a number of technical questions were raised, I'd like to call Bob Stelnacker of the Division of Retirement and Benefits first, and then John Cox of the Division of Insurance. And then I will read this essentially to my normal order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record again, my name is Bob Stelnacker. I'm Acting Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The department is neutral on the bill. We, there, as I stated earlier, there are some technical amendments that we would propose that would allow the employers to not single out the alcohol illness in trying to deal with cost containment measures and helping to contain the cost of their whole policies. I don't think it would substantially change the bill, and in dealing with Senator Binkley's office, that's it's met with their agreement on those kind of amendments. I would be happy to answer any questions you have at this point on the state plans.
There were a number of questions raised of Representative Boyer. Are there questions?
Let me make sure, Mr. Stonecker, you're from the Division of Retirement?
Yes, sir.
And benefits.
And benefits. So now, how does this affect anything that you would be doing? How would this bill affect you?
Mr. Chairman, the Division of Retirement and Benefits administers the state health plans as well as the retiree health plans for all retirement or all the members of the public, employees, teachers, and various other retirement systems of the state. Any type of mandated coverage could affect the health plan that the state currently provides. At this point in time, the state's health plan, and it always has provided for coverage for alcoholism and drug abuse. There are some differences in how we currently cover that this bill would have us to change some things, but it would not create a fiscal impact. It would broaden the ability to provide coverage through outpatient care, but we would anticipate because outpatient care is more available that usage would go up, so it would be a net wash. But that's about the only effect this would have on their state retirement.
You made a statement a minute ago that one technical amendment is something that you would propose. Would you do that again? Just repeat that again.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, the amendments, and there's about three of them that we've discussed.
Are they before us at this time? Are they
no.
It's my understanding
have
you have
them. Not before us.
But I mean, there are in the packet here.
Yes, they are in the packet.
Some amendments.
Okay, and I don't have a copy of that.
That's the one, AB.
Right.
And that'll be amendment number 2.
1683AB.
Yes, this is 1683AB.
That's it, Mr. Chairman. If they are before, so we can go back. I'm just ready to go through.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tell us roughly the percentage of use of this particular. In other words, on the total or total amount of claims paid, roughly how much of it comes under this particular act in any given year?
We don't have that number. Okay. Mr. Chairman, we have been asked for that information. We have talked to our carrier, and we're awaiting those kind of numbers. That's not something they would normally split
no.
out, but they're in the process of trying to determine that number.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you. And I'd like to Don Cox, the region attorney. More technical questions?
I have one, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Koch. I'm special deputy with the Division of Insurance, also chief of market surveillance.
Representative Menard is here.
I have not prepared any specific written amendments, so I was a little surprised to be shown those, although some of the comments there do address some things we talked about generically in the Senate hearings. And some of those are also things that are contained in a memo from Jim Jordan, who is our market analyst in Anchorage, who deals with life and health insurance issues. I did pose a number of issues at the hearing on the Senate side, and I think that Representative Boyer has addressed a number of those, so I'm not sure how far we ought to talk about them. The concerns that we had, and incidentally, I should state right up front, our position on the bill is one of supporting the concept. There are technical amendments that we felt were necessary. I think some of those have been addressed. I'm not sure that all of them have been addressed. One of our concerns that we expressed in the Senate, and in a meeting yesterday morning with Senator Binkley, Representative Boyer, and others, was the reach of this project, this mandate. As has already been noted, it does not reach self-insurers, although I'm happy to hear that a number of them are voluntarily providing that kind of a benefit. We can't reach the METs by mandate. But again, because there are a number of states that are providing this kind of benefit, you probably are going to accomplish what you need to accomplish with those. What I would like to do, if I may, is to leave a copy of Jim Jordan's comments, which is primarily intended to be an internal document that discusses in a great deal of detail some of the concerns with the concepts. It's not intended to be, at least for this purpose, not intended to be a position paper as to how we will address the bill, because this is an analysis that may sound somewhat negative in areas, but at least it points up some of the difficulties. With that, I would be happy to answer questions. Like I say, I just saw some of the amendments that are proposed just before the hearing started.
Representative Boyer.
Yes. Sorry to say, I'm not quite prepared to speak to all the rooms.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coe, could I ask you to look at page 3, line 15 through 23, section 3, and explain what this section means, what it says?
Sure. That one I can hear.
Okay.
Thank you. 2187 is a statute in the insurance code that deals with hospital medical service corporations. That statute is an exclusive statute. In other words, unless there's an internal reference within that statute, no other statutes in the insurance code apply to it. So in order to bring in outside references, such as the one that this will be, which is made in 2142, in order to bring in that and apply it to a Blue Cross or a Blue Shield, you have to make an internal reference in 2187. So basically what they're doing here, or what's being done here, on page 4, you'll notice item 15 is referencing the new statutes that are a part of this thing and saying that these also apply to a Blue Cross or a Blue Shield.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I may proceed then. So the reference on page 4, line 19, to service corporations, speaking primarily to insurers like Blue Cross or whatever?
It's speaking to a hospital or medical service corporation, and we only have two or three of them. Delta Dental is a service corporation, a medical service corporation. The Last Division Services is a medical service corporation, and Blue Cross is a hospital service corporation. Those are three entities that are formed under that statute.
I just wonder, and I'm sure this is existing statute. Is there a way of maybe rewriting this to basically simplify it? This is a...
As long as it remains internal to Chapter 87, I don't think that's a problem, if that's a concern.
Just looking at the presentation, trying to really read this and understand what it's saying. Your explanation satisfied me, but when you read this and try and really follow the flow...
Without reading 87 in context, it's difficult to follow the flow because it's unusual to have a statute that's exclusive to itself. In other words, where other provisions that might ordinarily apply to that type of entity don't apply unless there's a specific internal reference. And that was done with great deliberation, and you'll find that's typically the way it's done in other jurisdictions where a Blue Cross or a Blue Shield, a hospital medical service corporation, is isolated from other aspects of the insurance code.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I should mention, Mr. Chairman, if I may, there is one other entity that falls into the same kind of a scene, and those are fraternal benefit societies that are formed under 84. That has not been included in here. I'm not sure whether it's appropriate to include them or not. I'm not clear myself on what kinds of contracts they provide. But if they are providing hospital expense or medical expense types of coverage, then they ought to look at it. sure what they do provide. Jim Jordan in our Anchorage office can clarify that.
Thank you.
Jim Boyer has a question.
Mr. Chairman, more it's a statement rather than a question. And I just wanted to apologize for Mr. Cope on kind of dumping these amendments on him at such a short notice. We did meet yesterday as a group with Senator Binkley and discussed a number of things. And what we tried to do was quickly respond to those by taking the technical concerns that were incorporated in this memo and in our discussion, and then come to pulling together the amendments so that we would have them ready and prepared in the event that the committee was interested in entertaining a committee substitute, so that you would have the technical amendments before you for that. That's so I apologize. And
I was a surprise.
Sometimes we're over trying to be too efficient, too fast.
There was one additional issue, which is I note on the sheet that was shown to me before the hearing started, that is basically a policy consideration, which I'd just like to call your attention. And that is, we do have a kind of mandated insurance right now in the state, automobile insurance, which has a mandate for uninsured motorist coverage. That particular mandate for the uninsured motorist coverage is something that provides coverage for the individual who's buying the coverage. It has a provision in there that allows that individual to opt out. One of the suggestions we made yesterday at the meeting, and I can understand this one is a little controversial with some of the parties that are interested, was to allow a written waiver by somebody who wants to opt out. The approach that I noticed is in the amendments that I was shown before the hearing started, shows that if a firm has 20 or less employees, they may opt out with something like that. That's one approach. It's also something to consider as an alternative, but only that. It's really a policy decision.
One of the questions that you raise is the coverage due to contracts issued in other states applying to Alaska residents that may not provide that. In other words, that we can't tell them how to.
That's correct.
Right. But in essence, they are applying a sort of extraterritoriality to Alaska, and that they're applying the law of that state to Alaska.
Yes, sir.
Is there any way that which raises the same constitutional question in reverse? In other words, is there any way that we can provide that they will be covered not necessarily by that policy, but if they're working in Alaska, they get covered by a policy covering. If they're not covered by a policy to which the Alaska law applies, that they have to be covered by a separate policy that does apply it?
I believe not. ERISA provides, which is federal law, provides a preemption in effect for those kinds of things.
I think if non-ERISA kind of coverage is...
If the coverage is purchased in another state, primarily for those entities in that state, MATs, you're not going to be able to reach them with Alaska law at all. There was some discussion
in the state because they don't comply with the law.
There was some discussion at one time. Well, the difficulty with this whole arena is that you're talking a voluntary coverage with a mandated provision, so that if you buy that, you have
to. So we would have to have mandated coverage.
I think in order to
automobile.
If it were to be made workable at all, you'd almost have to have a mandated health insurance contract and then mandate the coverages within that. I think that's opening the real Pandora's box there. I'm not sure what the federal law barriers would be there, because I don't think you can still reach the self-insurance. I think the feds have very clearly said hands off.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. We have a number of other witnesses, and the first one would be Gary Jenkins. And his
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Jenkins. I represent the National Federation of Independent Business in the state of Alaska. And it probably won't be any surprise to most of you that small business around the state is not particularly enamored with this concept. There are a variety of issues that come up when you look at it. But first of all, I would just like to state for the record, as I think most of you realize, NFIB has a longstanding policy that any position that their lobbyist takes is reflective of a specific vote of the membership on the issue. And this is an issue that was presented to our membership in a couple of years ago. We were anticipating it coming up, and our membership basically voted 75% against any type of this type of mandated coverage versus 15% for, and another 10% basically saying they didn't have enough information one way or the other to vote. So there's a very strong feeling in opposition to this. And the more I listen to the testimony this morning, the more I realize that this really is, in essence, a mandated benefit for Small Business Alaska, because as has already been testified before this committee, the state already provides it. Major employers in the state apparently provide it. So in essence, what this bill is saying is that we now are going to mandate that any small business in the state shall provide it if they provide health insurance. Representative Boucher has already brought up, you know, the very concern that small business is concerned with, and that is there's a cost. We don't know what the cost is, but there's a cost that goes with any type of a required benefit. A small business has a choice, as Representative Boyer pointed out. They can, in this case, drop the insurance totally. They can reduce coverage. They can increase deductibles. But what you're looking at is you're looking at some kind of a trade-off. And generally, the employee is going to suffer one way or the other. The third alternative would be if the employer felt strongly that they wanted to maintain their level of coverage and include a mandated benefit, the implication could well be that there would be just a reduction in the number of employees. The employer then would reduce employment. I think it's been brought out very clearly in a lot of the testimony before this committee on workers' comp, that you know, costs go so high and you just can't afford to hire people. So that, you know, it is a very serious concern to small business. I very much concur with the suggestion that has been brought before the committee of an opt-out provision, that if a company has less than 20 employees, that they would have the option of not providing this type of coverage. I don't have any absolute documentation, but it's been my impression from my personal experience that as the size of a group goes down, the cost for coverage goes up. So there's a significant benefit that goes with large group coverage all over the state. I do know, I was just doing a little quick checking, and I could be corrected, but looking at the state policy, Representative Boucher raised the issue of, unless I'm misinformed, that the state policy now costs $325 a month per employee. And I would suggest there are a few small businesses out there that can afford anything approaching that kind of a cost. Now, I recognize state policy is a very generous policy that includes a wide variety of coverages, but it is also a very expensive policy. That really is the thrust, you know, of our testimony. We just really have a strong concern that anytime something's mandated, something else has to be given up. You know, and it's going to be jobs or it's going to be benefits that the employees would otherwise have. Thank you.
For the record, I'd like to say Representative Donnelly is here and is assuming the chair.
Representative Copeland?
Yes. We've had testimony in other contexts that a very small percentage of small business has any sort of health coverage. For the precise reason that you pointed out, that Blue Cross is the only outfit that offers it to small groups, and that they start at about $1,200 per person and going up to about $2,000, which is beyond the ability of most small businesses in Alaska. Do you have a notion of how many small businesses in Alaska and of what size actually provide any form of health insurance for their employees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Copeland. No, I'm sorry, I do not. Now, there is an alternative that I know a lot of small businesses do use. It is true that you cannot buy a group policy, but I know a lot of small businesses will, in fact, and do, in fact, buy individual policies for their employees. And they basically pay the premiums. So that's the alternative to a quote-unquote group plan. But the policies, as a general rule, are more expensive buying them.
I'd be grateful if you could give us any data.
Representative Boyer.
Well, just to answer that last point then, Mr. Chairman, individual policies under one of the amendments that we're proposing are excluded in any event and wouldn't then have to reflect the cost of this mandated coverage. It's one of the amendments, and clearly that was an oversight on our part, but we weren't intending to affect individual policies. So for those small businesses that do provide individual coverage through individual policies, that would not be affected. Now, small businesses may decide as a result, though, of the passage of this bill to include that as a benefit that they seek in the individual policy, but it wouldn't be mandated.
Mr. Chairman, okay, this is your comment about major medical
early on. Right, if those amendments were adopted, another amendment that was in there besides the major medical was one that would just make it effective for group policies. Sorry,
thank you.
I hadn't mentioned that one in my remarks. I did have a couple of questions, though. You had mentioned that 75% of small businesses polled had rejected this type. You said any type of mandated coverage. So it isn't specific to this. It's generally general in scope.
That is correct.
Okay. And what has been then the response to small businesses in the state to the fact that in the last 2-year period, then we've added at least 3 types of mandated coverage? You had mentioned that when something comes in, something has to go out the window, and I'd be real interested in knowing from your organization what it is generally or very specifically that's gone out the window as a result of the mandating of at least those 3 other coverages.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that kind of information available, but you know, I guess when you look at, I would differentiate between the 3 types that have been adopted in the last year or so, by which we're dealing with certain types of providers being generally included as compared to a broad sweeping type of coverage, which is more of a generic type of thing. Obviously, what would happen in looking at the 3 different types of providers is it would just give the person the option of going to one of those 3 instead of somebody else. So I would seriously doubt that it actually would have an impact on rates. And that would be my reaction. And perhaps there's somebody here that's from the Division of Insurance or someone else that could answer that. But it would seem to me that's strictly a trade-off. This is not a trade-off. This is going to be a required type of thing that's going to result in some type of an increased cost.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I agree with that. In those 3 particular situations, you were dealing with physical therapists, naturopaths, and I forget now the other one. But those are mandated, period, and they weren't. They didn't force you to go to one particular person or another or one group. They were very broad, and they provided that general and very broad kind of coverage as well. So there's no difference, in my mind, between that kind of general broad coverage and this general broad. There's a very specific kind of coverage. That's true. In all cases, it's a very specific kind of coverage, but it's no different in this application.
Okay.
Just one of in Alaska is if that's 3 employees or less or 5 employees or less. I don't know, and I thought maybe I'd ask what the definition of small business is in Alaska, because we don't want to hurt the very small business. I think, though, there must be some cutting line, though, between small and other businesses.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there is any generic definition anywhere as to, quote unquote, what is a small business. I mean, you get involved in dealing with different agencies, and every agency's got a different definition. You deal with SBA, and it's if your gross receipts is under $1 million a year or $10 million a year, some astronomical figure, you know, which clearly would not be applicable to what we're talking about. Generally, we look at something from our membership point of view. I don't have an exact figure with me, but I'm sure the vast majority of our membership would fall under an under 20 classification. We do have some businesses that are members that would have more than 20 employees. But if you look at a business that has a few temporary employees and as well as their permanent employees, it's very easy to get up to 20 and still not be a very big business, especially when you have seasonal type fluctuations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Davidson, then Representative Menard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jenkins, your organization frequently seems to be on the cutting edge of trying to do good things for small business. And
and I've had my own experience as a small businessman, and I know that it's not an easy route. But to step back and try to get a look at the big picture here, I think everyone at this table would like to see the state get out of the business of mandating and into the business of incentives. So my question is, given this particular piece of legislation, what do you see are the incentives that might be available to the members of this committee to offer your organization to get them interested in this kind of preventive approach to some of the problems in healthcare?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davidson, that is an interesting question. I really hadn't approached it candidly from that perspective, and as a result, don't have a good answer for you. I guess I'd have to give some serious thought to it as to what could be put out there as incentives. I have to be candid. I just really haven't looked at it from that perspective, and so could not give you a good answer at this point.
Representative Menard, you represent first.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jenkins, on a small business, you feel that if this was mandated on small business, something has to give, and one of the things that may have to give are the number of employees that an employer would have.
Right.
On would you, some of the employers, would they not look at the benefit package that they would get if this was in the benefit package and adjust their per hour rate to their employees to a certain extent to see if they were in the ballgame on that?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure they would. There's a variety of things, although it's almost impossible to actually cut your direct wages back. You just get too negative reaction from people.
Yeah.
So the normal alternative is you then start looking at adjusting the deductibles or reducing coverages somewhere else, to bring that cost back down. You start adjusting so that you can keep your total costs in line. If you're in a situation where, for some reason, there's a formal agreement where they didn't have that alternative, then their only fallback would be is to limit the number of employees, type of thing.
One other question on to Representative Copeland. I think there are a couple of other companies that, besides Blue Cross, that write for smaller groups. I know our group has one, and it's not Blue Cross for healthcare coverage.
Blue Cross is the only one that we found that generally writes. However, you're right in the fact that there are professional groups that provide coverage, and also institutional groups, for instance, Lutheran Hospitals and Homes has its own policy, and I presume you're speaking of the Dental Society's coverage. And those are not available in the sort of general way that to the general public in the way that the Blue Cross is available. So you're right, there are other coverages, but we didn't find any that offered it generally to any small company or any long life.
Representative Curtis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jenkins, I've read this bill several times, and I'm still trying to get a good handle as to whether it mandates specifically. I draw your attention to lines 20 through 27, page 1, section 2142, 3, section 5, and if I could paraphrase it, it says an insurer, and I take an insurer to be an insurance company providing coverage, shall not, it shall provide the insured, which I take that to be an employer or subscriber, an employee, the following coverage for treatment of alcoholism or drug abuse. Now, with that in mind, the question still hangs in my mind, is the employer required to offer this coverage? Perhaps a sponsor could ask that, or in your opinion, are they required to provide it? Now, you mentioned three options here. You should they either drop it, reduce the coverage, or basically lay off employees. So, again, my question, is it mandatory that they offer this coverage or provide it to the employee?
Representative Boyer?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's the insurer who, the insurance company, the person doing the insurer, it says, who's authorized under 2109, who offers the insurance that has to provide the coverage. It's not the employer who has to accept that. I mean, an employer could not cover his employees with that coverage, or he could limit the number of people that were covered. Say, if he were offering a family plan, he could whittle that back to accommodate the cost of that additional alcoholism and drug abuse treatment coverage. He could offer that only to his employees, opposed to the family. And those are options that the employer can exercise. It's just this only mandates the insuring company to provide that in their policy. So every policy would have it. You go to buy policy A, and it's going to have medical, or it's going to have alcoholism and drug abuse in it. It's going to have that in the policy. So
if I may follow up, then
I got confused there. I thought I understood where we were going now.
I was actually mixing two things. I was trying to jump ahead to the issue of how you pay for that. It's going to be in the policy, so it's going to be offered. It just, and how you pay for that is an employer option. You can, if there's an additional cost at all.
Oh, Representative Boyer, then you're saying that it'll be mandated in all insurance policies, but who pays for it, whether it's the employer or the employee, is a matter between the two of them.
That's right. It could either be negotiated if you're covered by a bargaining unit, or it could be something. It's a bargaining deal in any event.
Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up.
Representative Ferguson.
Mr. Jenkins, if we agree with that interpretation, and you mentioned here your various concerns, and it seemed to be the center of your concern that it was a mandatory coverage that the employer would have to provide. Am I stating it correctly?
If they provide insurance at all. If they buy insurance, coverage number one is going to be this coverage, because it's not going to be required coverage.
Now, under your understanding that if an employer or a company offered a health program that included this coverage, that they would have to offer it to their employees.
That is correct.
Okay, now if I may go back to the sponsor. I don't read that in the bill, but is that your interpretation?
Anyone who offers medical coverage in the state of Alaska, and we want to call that now major medical.
No, let's speak of the employer, not the insurer.
If you were providing insurance to any employee,
okay,
as a group of folks, it would be covered under this bill. It is mandated that group of employees or employee would receive this coverage if you pass this bill, because the insurance company has it as part of their package. If you have dental, optical, any major medical, this would then just be one additional thing that's in that package of benefits that you then make available.
So what you're saying then, there's a laundry list, and they don't have a choice of excluding some of those. One of those laundry list items, one of those categories, would be this particular coverage, and that employer would have to offer that to the employee.
Those things that I listed may or may not, none of those were mandated coverages. The only one that I mentioned that was mandated, would be mandated, is alcoholism and drug abuse. But yes, there is a laundry list of things which an insurance company might offer. And to an individual who buys a policy, you can choose which one of those you want to avail yourself of. And I'm a company doing business, and what I know is that that policy is going to have, at a minimum, coverage for newborns, coverage, theoretically, for alcoholism and drug abuse. So I know I'm going to have to pay for some certain kind of baseline coverage for my employee. If I want to provide any coverage, I'm going to have to provide those.
It's clear as mud. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Six or one and half a dozen of another. Okay. Pay either way.
Now I've got another follow-up question. If the employer goes out and gets this insurance package to provide to his or her employees, and the employer makes the decision that they're not going to pay for that portion that involves the mandated portion that's mandated by this legislation, and the employee refuses to pay for it, what happens?
They have to.
Yeah,
has to pay for it.
At that point, the employer can either decide to continue coverage or to provide the coverage, any level of coverage, which is the option, or to provide the coverage which would include this, alcoholism and drug abuse. It's we're making it, I think, much more involved than it needs to be. In most states where this has been offered, in fact, in the state, when at the Civil Liberties Union review of those six states that had actually had it recently offered, they said that none of the sources in their study in the study states indicated that there had been any plans terminated due to the implementation of mandated benefits.
So what you're saying is you'd have to terminate the whole plan.
You'd have to terminate the whole plan or choose not to buy a plan.
Right.
You see. And that, I mean, in this one study anyway, doesn't bear out. I mean, there aren't people who have a policy who are now all of a sudden their policies went upon renewal are going to have this additional mandated coverage. There aren't companies going out to do away with the coverage. That's just it isn't unless there people have new numbers or from other states or something. But that isn't the track record that people are pushing these policies away now because they're mandated coverage. And it isn't the history that this has caused a large increase in the policies either and the policy price. And the numbers here are 0.5% to 1% in some cases. Yeah. So I mean,
are there further questions for Mr. Jenkins? Representative Boucher.
Just an observation, and excuse me, I was asking a question. And as I understand, we were talking about mandated insurance right now. There's only one thing that's mandated. Is that correct?
There is one mandate now for newborn children if the policy provides coverage for dependent children.
It's not mandated for eye care,
yes,
dental,
yes,
loss of arms. But these two, if we pass this, they would be mandated
at some level.
Which gives you the stipulation?
Well, do more people need dental care or eye care, or might we not be losing dental and eye care? Say, well, if we're going to have to pay for drug rehabilitation and alcoholism, then maybe we better pull out that part that takes care of dental care. Might we not? You learn something every time, and only ask a question. Might that not be left with the option with the employee who had previously been giving dental care or eye care? Say, well, you know, if we now are mandated to handle the alcoholism and the drug, then we are going to stop mandating, including eye care as a part, or are these separate and apart? Maybe somebody out here with more wisdom than I could answer that.
Okay, Representative Boyer, then Representative Furness.
We need an insurance provider to ultimately answer the question. But one, you'd only contemplate that if you had an increase in cost of the policy that was something that you felt you couldn't bear, and at 0.5% or even 1%. Additional cost to your premium on a per year basis, you might make that decision to look at some of the other things, but you probably wouldn't. You're probably not going to do that. There's a trigger in place too, and that is if you adopt the amendments that we've proposed, that you have to be providing major medical. It only affects insurers who are providing major medical coverage. Major medical, again, we need an insurance company, someone who sells this stuff to tell us what major medical means. Actually, there is a definition, but it's a whole host of things, a whole array of coverage. Anyway, I mean, that's the trigger. You have to be providing a major medical policy. And then if you are, which takes care of a lot of these other things, then this kicks in. So there's a trigger mechanism. It isn't as if you have a whole lot of these separate things and you could pick and choose. I don't think that you're going to find that taking place, but that may be a feeble attempt at answering the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Barrier, you had indicated some amendment to give employers of less than 20 employees an ability of opting out. I assume that's not part of the amendment package today.
That's correct. It's not part of the package. And 20 was not a number that I would use and not a number that I'm comfortable with. I think that's someone else's number. But
I picked it up in some conversation.
Yeah. 20 would probably take care of 96% or 98% of small businesses in the state, and I'm not sure that I want to let that many businesses out of the pool here just yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any further questions for the witness? Not. Thank you. Testimony today. I'm not sure if these people just signed up to testify or not. Tom Armstrong, did you wish to testify on this legislation?
Just very briefly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Armstrong. I'm with Milam Recovery Centers. I also, Milam Recovery Centers, which is a private treatment agency that has three treatment centers in Alaska. an outpatient agency in Fairbanks, in Anchorage, and one here in Juneau.
What are you specialized in?
Alcoholism and drug treatment.
Mr. Armstrong, before you leave today, if you had a business card you could give the staff, it'd be appreciated. Okay, please proceed.
From that perspective, I wanted to make sure the committee was aware about the size of the problem, namely that as many as 3 out of 10 people who may walk into any one of our agencies on a given day may be employed, may have insurance, and find when they go to seek treatment that the insurance does not at all cover alcoholism or drug abuse, or covers it with some eccentric and bizarre provisions like it can only take place in a general hospital or it only can be given by an MD. And the result is very often that the person either has to go and try to borrow money for treatment or that they turn away in frustration. Sometimes these are kids who finally parents have gotten to the point of wanting to get treatment and there simply isn't the money. To us, it's a question of parity, that if those same people walk in and we look at their health insurance policies, if they need a treatment for cancer, if they need a treatment for heart disease, it is there in equal amounts to whatever limit is necessary. But for whatever reason over the years, the insurance industry, and certainly not goaded on by employers, because I think we have a kind of collective denial sometimes that we don't have alcoholics in my company, or we don't really want to offer this insurance because it makes us look as if we want to take care of these people. But for whatever reason, it has lagged far behind the other kinds of diseases that we treat, despite the fact that 30 years ago the AMA declared it was a disease. So the problem is very real. My experience for 7 years as chief of the Office of Alcoholism in Washington, when we first passed a law mandating alcoholism insurance, but had no teeth in it in terms of a what level, was that in the interim period, there was very little change in what an insurer offered in terms of alcoholism insurance, until the insurance commissioner turned around and said, we have to put some teeth in it. Many of those provisions that you see in this law already exist in alcoholism in Washington regulation about alcoholism, simply to make it equitable in the provision of that insurance by insurers. And that was the intent of the regulations passed in Washington. To my knowledge, in Washington, and I've talked with the insurance commissioner, there's been no company that's gone to self-insurance because of the onus of putting this package in. There have been no companies who have complained that they're not going to offer group health insurance anymore because of the onus. And the increases in premiums range from 2.5% to 8% in the Washington companies that came forward to increase this. So those are the main points I wanted to offer.
Representative Furness and Representative Boucher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Armstrong, is it your contention then that a policy that provided the coverage without some formal mandating it, that the employer most oftentimes would not purchase it?
Generally, if it was seen as at all any added cost. And as I say, there are policies out there that cover it, but have a limit, for instance, of $500. They may have a $100,000 limit for cancer, but it's a $500 limit or an onerous copayment, a 50% copayment, while on a cancer treatment, they may only have a 20% copayment.
Further questions for the witness? Representative Boucher?
How many clinics do you have?
3 in Alaska, 3 outpatient clinics in King County, and a residential inpatient clinic in King County.
Did you work on the law in Washington?
I worked on the regulations in Washington. The law had already been passed by the time I was in office as the alcoholism.
Where are your 3 clinics here?
Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage.
How many people are you treating?
In each of the clinics? Probably on a given year, an average of 300 to 500 people.
How many people are you turning away?
Probably on an average of 300 to 500 total.
You're turning away. Have you kept records of those?
Generally, yes.
And
very often what will happen was it will be that we will refer them whenever possible to public programs who will take them.
we will have examples.
How many people have come back to you and say there's no public program? I'm just talking about the solution to the problem. I recognize we got the problem.
There'll be a number. Very often they won't come back. What will happen is the downward spiral continues. To me, the saddest part of it is that when, it, for instance, if somebody who's employed who comes in and doesn't have insurance, and he may be on that precarious balance of his work is suffering, he's already being a drag on his business. He finally, for whatever reason, knows that he's in trouble, wants treatment, finds that he doesn't have the insurance, and he decides to gut it out. Perhaps if he's lucky to go stay at, perhaps he doesn't. The family's in uproar because you've got to realize that we've got four other people here who are affected by this disease. And if treatment isn't immediate and prompt, what may happen is, and what very often happens, all right, the person ends up getting fired. Now he becomes the public responsibility, and now the public sector has to kick in. And I think George has $1 figures in terms of what we already pay in the cost in government of alcoholism and drugs. And it's nationally about $80 billion a year, the last report I had, in terms of lost production and lost work time.
One final question. Well, the people that you say you treat, about 300, and you turn away 300.
That's 300 and 500 in each clinic, 300 and 500 total. So it's about a quarter, probably, total that are turned away.
Are any of those that you're currently treated, are they covered by any insurance?
Yes.
They are. What percentage of them?
The ones that we are treating, probably 80%.
They're covered by insurance, and it's not mandated.
There's another 20% who are at least digging into bank accounts, borrowing from friends, whatever, to get the treatment.
So there is some insurance out there.
There is some insurance.
There are some
the problem very often is in the kinds of levels that are covered. And one of the, I think, things that the bill does is that it leaves it up to the professionals to really determine where treatment should be. For instance, there are policies right now that if you came to Milam and Juneau, your policy will say they will pay for inpatient treatment for you to go to Anchorage, Seattle, wherever. They will not pay for outpatient treatment at all. Now, you may very well get well faster in the community and not need inpatient treatment, but very often you may make the decision, well, they're going to pay some of the inpatient, they won't pay the outpatient treatment, so I'll have to leave the community for 28 days. Take that treatment, rather stay in the community because I can't afford to pay for the outpatient treatment. So it's kind of a strange levels of coverage too that we're trying to address.
Might that not be better adjusted within the private sector, if you were?
Well, to the degree that the problem you get into, I think, when you, and I deal a lot with insurers, with that system of Blue Cross. When you go to them, what they very often will say is, we'll do whatever the employer wants.
Whatever,
and the employer says, we'll do whatever the insurer suggests. And you get caught in this kind of whirlpool with no one, you know, making a statement, yeah, this seems to be the wisest thing to do.
Well, my concern here is there are evidently a number of people that are insuring and people being treated. One never knows where alcoholism or drug, what is the proper level of treatment. But it would seem to me that this fails to recognize people that are already trying to do a job out there. Maybe it isn't the best or what have you. And Company A out here is doing a job. We mandate insurance to a certain level. Now, Company A has to, although its program may be just working fine, along comes the state, well, no, your program, we mandate the program, you must put a certain dollar amount in it, am I correct? Mm-hmm. So they would have to, although that grandfathered in 1989, the minute the insurance was renewed, they would have to come up to that program.
That's correct.
I got a problem with that. I mean, especially if the program is working.
I think that the perhaps part of the response is that what the intent is to treat it like any other illness, so that if they treat cancer
That's a social problem we're dealing with. When the people decide alcoholism and drug abuse, that's a whole social problem.
Well, except alcoholism and drug addiction are recognized medical diseases in the same way that cancer is, heart disease, and the rest. Should they not then be given the same sort of focus in terms of what you give your employees?
Who's in first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Armstrong, are you finding that because of the level of these problems in the state of Alaska, are the private employers becoming more receptive to providing coverage?
I think there are any number, I think Representative Bench's comment about people are doing good jobs. There are employers who have excellent employee assistance programs, who indeed look out very well for their employees, and who could be models for any place in the country. And I think those kinds of companies have worked very closely with us, as well as all other treatment providers. In some cases, municipalities, in some cases, oil companies, in some cases, any number of the airlines. So I think that it is important to say that there are employers who are doing a very good job. There are others who are not doing a very good job for whatever reason. And I think it's kind of like sometimes with prevention. You hold prevention programs in schools, and very often who comes are the people who don't need it. The parents weren't doing a good job. And I don't know if that's the fact, but it may be that there are parts of the industry who would rather look the other way and lose employees rather than provide the benefit which would save the employee and put them back to productive and member of their workforce.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up with an additional question, perhaps comment. You've indicated in your testimony today that there are glitches in policies. For example, a policy may provide for in-house treatment versus external treatment. It appears to me that one of the things you're asking for is that hopefully this legislation will at least provide a more equitable, more balanced level of care. You mentioned a term to put it on par with other types of treatments. If a person has cancer, chances are there's a wide range of options there and it's not so narrowly defined. It appears to me that probably is one of your major concerns, and it looks as if we could somehow in this legislation at least open that, where you're not looking at these little glitches, that it has to be an in-facility treatment as opposed to external treatment or whatever else, rather than tackling, at least making it a mandatory coverage. It appears to me that that's maybe is the way to go at this time, at least. Senator, you should say it's the camel's nose under the tent. That will at least address it partially. Is that mandatory coverage sort of worries me, particularly in light of the status of our small business communities.
Okay, gentlemen, we have about four other members of the public side to testify. If you've got questions for this witness, please proceed. But
I would like, if he could supply me the figures of the an accurate figure of the people that are turned away, those that are treated and those that are turned away.
Okay. Thank you. Judy Bixby.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Judy Bixby, and I'd like to offer testimony, both personal and professional, in support of this legislation. The personal side of my testimony is that 6 years ago, when I was suffering from the disease of alcoholism, it was necessary that I receive treatment to arrest my disease. I was employed at that time, and the insurance coverage I had mandated that I enter an inpatient or hospital treatment facility. If given the choice at that time, I would have chosen an outpatient program where I could have retained my employment. Another thing deprived me by a policy that did not cover outpatient treatment was that I couldn't set up a sober support system in the community I was to live in, and my family couldn't be part of the essential family component that treatment offers. The professional side of my testimony is simple. I now work in the treatment field and devote a great deal of my professional time working with the adolescent population. 3 weeks ago, I assessed a 16-year-old female for alcoholism. She had slit her wrists in a suicide attempt behind too much alcohol. She was diagnosed as middle-stage alcoholic, and the recommendation was for her to enter the protective environment of an inpatient treatment facility where she could be removed from her drug of choice. Upon checking her family's insurance policy, I found a 60% coverage to $2,000 for inpatient treatment and no coverage for outpatient treatment. The father is a single parent and has three other children. Needless to say, he was devastated that we couldn't obtain the treatment that she needed. And I, of course, remain frustrated to this day dealing with these kind of cases on a daily basis. What's important to note is that it's not an isolated case, and that daily I see kids and adults denied the help they need in arresting a fatal disease because insurance policies just deny them the coverage or deny them adequate coverage to get the help they need. And I ask that you consider this piece of legislation in hopes that more Alaskans can and will get help for a disease that, while fatal, if left untreated, is treatable.
Thank you for your testimony. Other questions for the witness? Representative Menard.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judy, do you know what the success rate is with outpatients versus inpatients? Or is there something that can answer that?
Well, I think that I've worked in the field for several years, and I think that it's, it depends on the stage of the diseases. And, you know, I think a lot of people are more appropriate for outpatient, say they're in the earlier stages of the disease, and they can retain their employment and work and come to treatment at night and can set up that silver support system, then it's real appropriate. And I think what's frustrating to me is that you do a professional medical diagnosis and recommend either inpatient or outpatient, depending on what stage the disease is in, and then the insurance companies end up mandating what kind of treatment the person gets rather than the designated profession.
Further questions for the witness? Thank you for your testimony today. Dick Luther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Luther, and I'm testifying based on my experience having a family member who required treatment for chemical dependency. I'm not going to go into the benefits of the treatment, however, I would say that they were considerable. What I want to talk about is the insurance coverage that I had. At the time that my family member required treatment, I was a state employee and was covered by the state's insurance policy. There's been quite a bit said about that here this afternoon. And I think probably the state's coverage is as good as any available. However, there is a difference in that policy and the percentage that was paid for inpatient versus outpatient treatment. And that difference in percentage caused me to make some decisions that were based on fiscal concerns rather than what kind of treatment would have perhaps been better. First decision centered around the fact that I didn't feel that the problem was severe enough that it would require that the person be placed in inpatient treatment. The state's insurance paid a higher percentage for inpatient treatment, but it would have required that the person be sent out of town, and I was reluctant to do that. So that caused me to delay the treatment since I didn't feel it was severe enough. And because the percentage that was paid for inpatient or outpatient treatment wasn't high enough, I didn't feel at that time that I could afford it. So it would have caused me to delay the treatment and then to perhaps seek an inappropriate.
Excuse me, sir. Representative Boucher?
I want to ask you a question. The moment you made that decision, did you make that decision by yourself, or had you been consulting with, was it a family decision, or had you been consulting with a medical person?
It was a combination of things. I had an assessment that told me that there was a problem, but a lot of it was also based on my own perceptions in the family. It was a family decision. The problem was not severe enough. It was causing real problems within the family, but it was, you know, it wasn't to the point where you throw up your hands and say, I can't deal with it anymore.
Well, how about the individual itself, though? You were talking about the problems. Had you sought medical help at this particular time to determine whether the person needed the inpatient or the outpatient?
Yes, I had.
What did they say?
And it would have been appropriate at that time for the person to have been placed in outpatient treatment. But because the percentage at the state policy at that time would pay about 50% of outpatient treatment, and
so
I didn't feel that I could afford it.
You did seek medical help,
right?
And they told you that outpatient.
Okay, all right. Yeah. All right. So by the time that I did do something about it, I opted to have the person sent to inpatient treatment because for two reasons. One, by then I was at my wit's end, needed to do something, and the other thing, the insurance coverage was better for that. It paid a higher percentage. Had I gone with inpatient treatment earlier, I think probably that would have been inappropriate. It probably would have worked, and I wouldn't have had to gone with the with inpatient, which in reality cost more of the insurance company, but it didn't cost more of me. Maybe it was a selfish decision, but that's that was where I felt that I was. I needed to do that. I based the decision not on what was the most reasonable sound treatment philosophy, but rather on fiscal what I could afford. I think that that this piece of legislation addresses that, because it does even up the percentages that are paid for both inpatient and outpatient treatment. I think that, that what it does is gets back to where treatment is going to be based on what's needed rather than what insurance companies will pay. I think that the other thing that we'll do is provide for more equitable coverage for more people in the state. If you happen to be a state employee, you have halfway decent insurance coverage. If you're not, your insurance coverage may be pretty lousy. So I think that this bill addresses that, and it's going to be equitable for a larger percentage of the people in the state. And I think that probably the most important thing is that it's going to be based on what's needed rather than what percentage is paid for inpatient versus outpatient.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could pose a question to my old friend, Mr. Cutler here. We've heard today that oftentimes the policy will have certain very specific limitations that begin to create certain glitches. Is it possible that we can require the insurers, the companies that are providing this insurance, to sort of rethink their coverage provision without going to the mandatory coverage kind of thing that this bill is addressing?
Yeah, I think there is, Mr. Chairman Duncan. I think there is. I'm not quite sure what kind of language would be used, but one that you were basically getting close to a little while ago was to require that the treatment, that any policy that has benefits for an illness, treat alcoholism the same way. Difficulty there, however, is that the testimony that I've heard in this hearing and in the last one that I did was that you can get far more efficient and less costly treatment on an outpatient basis, because there are firms such as Mylan that specializes in these kind of things, and you may not be able to equalize it there. You can certainly equalize it on the hospital side just by saying it's a discrimination issue. But I'm not sure that by making it a discrimination issue is going to deal with the outpatient concern.
Representative, we're really running out of time. My intent is to put this into a subcommittee. Representative Boyer, you had an additional proposed amendment you wanted to make that isn't in written form yet, huh? So we're probably going to need to do that. There's two more members of the public to testify. I think we can have them testify before we lose our committee members here.
Thank you, sir.
Dave Lilly.
Mr. Chairman, I guess what we're saying here is I'd like to see this thing jawbone before we just apply a monetary solution to it that requires those people that are doing a good job to be penalized for those that were doing nothing. That's my concern for the thing.
That's why we're going to have a subcommittee to deal with it, so they can do that in subcommittee. So
because
that's a good point.
He's saying that, hey, let's talk about this a little bit.
Sure. Sir, could you proceed? Huh?
Yes, my name is Dave Lilly. I'm the administrator of the Juno Recovery Unit. The Juno Recovery Unit is administered by the City and Borough of Juno. About a third of our funding comes from the City and Borough, and about a third from a state grant, and a third from third-party payments and other kinds of revenues. So we're very interested in this bill, and I'm glad to have a chance to speak just briefly, and I'll have a lot more things to say if I do get a chance to speak before another subcommittee on this. The thing that I especially would like to speak to is the issue of it being a disease and it not being allowed by many of the insurance companies. I happen to have just one letter that I brought along from an insurance company, which is pretty representative. This is a letter which we got a copy of, which went to our former patient from a company, an Alaska company here. It says, under the terms of this particular insurance company, no benefits are allowed for the treatment of alcoholism dependents. Enclosed is a billing from Juno Social Services with a diagnosis for same. Unless another diagnosis is present, the charges are denied and will be your responsibility. As I say, that's really pretty typical. Although we are a licensed hospital, a licensed 15-bed hospital, with full medical coverage and are able to provide full medical detoxification and ongoing treatment of up to a month or so for alcoholics and other chemically dependent people, we get very few insurance payments. And as a matter of fact, about the only ones we get are from the state Aetna insurance. And this is the typical response we get. I've heard some testimony, and I know the state office's position paper, which we really agree with, points out the fact that some insurances will only cover in a hospital setting, but I can say as a hospital administrator that above and beyond that, many of the insurances just flatly won't cover chemical dependency in any kind of form. So we are concerned that this issue be addressed. We are a medical facility because we recognize alcoholism and other kinds of chemical dependency as a disease. I agree with the representative that it's a social problem, but it is a real actual medical disease, one that has been recognized by the American Medical Association and the World Health Organization for years as a disease and has undergone the rigorous kind of examination that they do to determine that things are diseases. And what's even more significant, I think, is that it's a progressive disease. It's not unlike cancer. We take for granted the fact that if a doctor identifies a cancer very early on in a patient, he wants us to do something about it right then. If he identifies it when it's the size of a pea, he doesn't wait till it gets to the size of a grapefruit to do something about it. And that's very similar with chemical dependencies. It's a progressive disease. Eventually, it's a fatal terminal disease. But it gets more difficult to treat as time goes along. We are a hospital, and as a hospital, we take people that are pretty well advanced. People that come into our facility usually are fairly chronic alcoholics and drug addicts. All of those people could have been treated if there had been treatment available and if they'd been motivated earlier on to get treatment in a less expensive kind of facility. It is a progressive disease that not only gets more terminal and more serious as time goes along, but more difficult to treat. The prognosis is kind of in reverse proportion to the amount of time that a person has the disease. The prognosis gets worse, the chances of a person recovering from the disease